Gangbusters. My name is Richard Lamparsky, and here in the studio with me are two actors. I think I'll let them introduce themselves. On my left,
Bob Dryden and Don McLaughlin.
Both members of the stock company of Gangbusters that I remember so well on Saturday nights. I refused to take my bath until I got to listen to Gangbusters. Was it always on Saturday when you worked it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, did it always have Sloan's Liniment as the sponsor?
No, I was just thinking about that, and it's a funny thing, I suppose, you know, I graduated from playing cops and chiefs of police and so on to the voice of, what was his name, Schwarzkopf.
Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf.
He did this for a long time, and then he no longer did it, and they gave this job to me. And it was a very simple job of opening the show with the words I cannot remember. I guess I blocked them out or something. Now in cooperation with something law enforcement agents.
Oh, police and law enforcement agents
throughout the
country.
Somebody brings you Gangbusters. And out of that grew that statement, you know, that you heard for years and years. We came on like Gangbusters because you were screaming by this time, you know.
Yeah, that was part of the milk thing.
Yeah, but this was always on Saturday night, but not always for Sloan's Liniment. I think that was the most famous sponsor, but we had...
That was the first sponsor.
Yeah, but we had others. I can't remember what they were now. A Bit of Honey? No, that was Counter Spy, and so was Gulf Oil, but we had something other than that, but it makes no difference. We got paid from the sponsor, whoever he was.
As I remember, Colonel Schwarzkopf was the man who broke the Lindbergh
case. Yes. He was probably the most famous law enforcement officer in America at that time, and then he retired or whatever. And they offered him this job as a sort of a status symbol for Gangbusters, and it was a cushy little thing he had for a number of years.
Well, Philip H. Lord, who produced Gangbusters, must have had an in with the police department. I remember he, from time to time, they would parade the just retired, usually head of the police department of Cincinnati or whatever the city happened to be, and he would say how he advised all of his men when he was the police commissioner to use Sloan's Liniment. One of those rough workouts that the police had to go through.
I think there were two things that gave Gangbusters in its day the feeling of reality that no other show of its kind had. One was the authentic voices of Colonel Schwarzkopf and the other man. And in the second place, I think it was the only show that never used music.
That's right.
It had a hardness and a steeliness about it, and a reality, I think, that came from the fact that it went on the air with no musical introduction at all, no music between scenes. It was stock.
I'm surprised that, as I said, you were members of a stock company, because it was sort of a Lord stock company, wasn't
it? Well, he had actors whom he thought were, you know, good types and real in their delivery of lines, not theatric and so on. So this is what he demanded. He didn't always get it, but this is what he wanted. And he had various favorites, and he used them over and over and over again. It was really...
But he also used a lot of other people. I mean, I think there were various orbits in his stock company. Some people were used all the time, or very frequently, and other people were used in secondary parts from time to time, so that overall, he probably had, I would say, 50 or 75 or even 100 actors and actresses whose services he called on more or less frequently.
He actually sometimes got him a little mixed up. Frank Reddick. Yeah. He never came into the studio or the end very much, you know, the end of the show. And he came in one day and he listened to Frank Reddick playing a very tough criminal and doing a beautiful job. And he said to Len Bass, his assistant at that time, he said, "Len, who is that actor?" He said, "We got to use him again." And Len said, "I couldn't tell him. He's been on every other show in the last 5 years."
What surprised me about the idea of the stock company is that it was one of the few shows I remember in radio that didn't have running characters. I mean, you all had to play different people every time you were on because they did a different authentic case history.
Well, they did
every week,
and of course they made the criminal the protagonist. Actually, the cops were always the dull kind of people, you know, that just sat around and issued you know, casual orders at their desks and so on as they surround the house and go through things with a fine-tooth comb and all that. But the criminals, you know, they always did a case. Wasn't it a sort of a case history of a criminal and a big job that he pulled? And the criminals were always traced from their first stepped a crime to their final extinction at the end, and it was a kind of a case history of a criminal, and this is, I think, what gave it sort of the interest, the public's interest in, you know, in the criminal mind, and the kind of, in a way, a bit of a glorification, I think, of...
Well, I think then, too, because this program, I think, started in the 30s, didn't it?
I believe it did. It was long before I got into, at least I'd heard it before I even came to New York.
I listened to Gangbusters in the early 30s when I was still doing homework in high school.
Well, it was on then. What I was going to say is, whereas the crime rate might not have been as high during the 30s, I think we had more gangsters.
It was just coming out of that famous Chicago era of...
Al Capone
Mad Dog Cole, Dillinger, Babyface Floyd.
That was sort of the end of that great organized crime thing and the various individuals and Ma, what was her name down
there? Ma Barker.
And all that sort of thing. And it was what the papers were filled with, and people were terribly interested in it. I was always surprised that after the Great War started, when our whole civilization tottered and, it was a very popular program. It was escape by this time, I suppose. People didn't want to hear about, you know, the Battle of the Bulge or whatever. They wanted to hear about Scarface so-and-so.
Good old American violence.
Yeah.
Do you think maybe criminals are becoming a little duller?
Well, they're much smarter. It's all terribly psychological.
It was very colorful in the 30s.
Well, they were colorful, but they just, you know, they snarled and shot the machine gun and everything. And it was all very simple black and white, I think. There was never any of these Freudian overtones or what their mothers didn't do for them or whatever. It seems to me it was just kind of a simple, hardcore criminal type.
Well, if there were Freudian overtones or things about their background, it was never developed, certainly. In the lore, there was very little sympathy.
No,
that there was no playground in their neighborhood had nothing to do with it.
No, they just liked to shoot, that's all.
You know, this program was actually produced, this particular segment of whatever became of, by a girl who used to play Gun Moll on Gangbusters, because she told me who to get, and if she hadn't been recently hospitalized, she'd be here. Bryna Rayburn.
Oh, Bryna.
Bryna Rayburn.
Yes.
Well, we certainly say hello.
Wonderful. She and I worked for about a week trying to get you all together.
Oh, yeah, I see.
She was marvelous. She was a very good radio actress. I haven't seen her very much on TV, but she was clever with the doubles and everything. She was a good worker.
Yeah, she worked that show a lot. She must have played Gun Moll.
She played everything. In her time, Bryna has played and beautifully played everything from young children to character women. She's an extraordinary talent.
And one Bryna Rayburn, and you had five or six women for your cast in the old days when we could double.
Where is Philip H. Lord now? Do you know what he's doing?
To the best of my knowledge, I've heard that he has retired to Maine and is proprietor of a very prosperous boat-building corporation, which seems an odd thing, but Phil was always one to land on his feet.
I can't imagine Philip Lord being in anything that was not prosperous in the long run.
Yeah, he's marked for success, even from the very beginning, although I did hear many... famous stories of his early trials in radio, which were pretty horrendous. He was broke in Hawaii. Remember, he did something with Seth Parker. They put the whole
world cruise, yes.
And he foundered off Australia, called the Australian Navy. I mean, cost thousands of pounds and shillings and pence to get him straightened out, and he wound up, I think, back in Honolulu, completely broke. And somebody said he had to swim out to some sponsor's yacht to sell him the original idea. But he did.
I want to talk more about Philip H. Lord in a minute, but while I have the engineer's attention, and if you'll cue up the record, we've talked now about that famous opening of Gangbusters. This is for kids who don't remember the program. When you hear the expression, coming on like Gangbusters, this is what we mean.
Gangbusters, the only national program to bring you authentic police case histories. Gangbusters, presented in cooperation with police and federal law enforcement departments throughout the United States. Gangbusters in America's crusade against crime.
That's what we were talking about.
They don't make them like that no more, do they?
Oh, it was nice.
Oh, how they used to work on those sound effects. I'll tell you, it took sometimes hours, you know, because the timing of those. They had the blocks for the marching feet and the shots, and it had to be. And he was meticulous about this. He would really rely, I think, more on sound effects than he did on actors. I think he believed them more. And he would work for hours on these things.
That's something I think will surprise a lot of people, that the networks all had a policy at that time that nothing could be recorded. Isn't that right?
Well, I guess it must have been. Later they did. Everything was recorded later.
I know, NBC but, and CBS, you could not record anything.
Because you walked up steps. I remember a sound man walked up one of those fake steps, and he was so carried away, he walked right off the top and fell about 4 feet and right during a show. So I guess, as I remember, all those the live guns, you know, and yet the machine gun was never live. Now, that had to be recorded. So I don't know. Maybe they mixed them up to some extent. But there was an awful lot of use of live props. We had some very clever men who were awfully good at that.
Well, one of the great things about the sound effects men, and I remember, is that the ability they had to cue recorded sound effects to come in at a split second in the script. The timing of the small recorded sound.
Yeah, when they got it in the groove and had to drop that needle exactly right for a shot, maybe that came between two words, you know, if it didn't come off. And of course, sometimes in the old days when they had the live gun, the gun wouldn't go off either, so they
that happened many times. So, many an actor had to stand there and say, oh, my angina pectoris.
I'm from Detroit, which is where the Green Hornet and Lone Ranger is from, and a few times that they took me to see those shows, you know, when I was a kid. I was just fascinated more by the sound effects man than by the actor. But I remember the first time I saw fire, it was a forest fire, I think, on the Lone Ranger, and as I recall, he was crackling cellophane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I just thought that was amazing. Well, it was, really, because it really sounded like fire.
They used dry handfuls of hay for large fires. And the cellophane was used for frying eggs or frying bacon as well, or a small forest fire.
We were talking about Philip H. Lord before we began that old recording.
It's Phillips H. Lord.
Is it really?
Yeah,
Phillips.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, like Phillips Holmes, the the actor.
Mm-hmm. How would you remember him? I mean, he wasn't around. He died about 1940, I remember, in the war.
Yes, he did. Right? He was in the Canadian Royal Air Force, I believe.
Yeah,
I remember him.
And
sure, very well.
Phillips Holmes. Taylor Holmes' son.
Yeah. His brother was married to Libby Holman.
Oh, well,
we also know.
There's research for you.
But he was, Mr. Lord was, I guess, the first independent producer in radio, wasn't he? In the all the books I have on radio, it said he was the first to bring in the package deal.
You know more about that than we would, I'm sure, because I wasn't aware of it, but it would seem that he would be, because it was always kind of startling in the industry that, like I said, he swam out to somebody's yacht with his script under his arm and really sold the job, you know, sold one of his shows that way, and that was unprecedented in those days, so... Possibly this is true.
Oh, no, wait a minute. It seems to me that most of the radio soap operas were brought in from the outside.
But they all came under the house. You see, he didn't actually come out of an advertising agency like...
I see.
Like Bend and Bowles and Blackett Sample Hummert in those days. They had all the soaps. And I believe Philip Morris, even Charlie Martin, it wasn't an independent thing. I think it was conceived in the studio, or in the agency, and he directed it. But Phil Lord, actually, we had an agency, yes, but it meant very little as far as the show.
How about the Goldbergs?
No, I don't know. I never worked that show, so...
It seemed to me that...
But he was,
I think... He created that.
In some sense, a pioneer in this whole field of radio production, and made a great mark, because he started out with, what was the thing that, the New England thing?
Seth Parker. Now, I don't remember that program.
Vaguely remember, but that was long before I got into radio, and he was quite a performer. Of late years, it was a strange thing. He didn't like to talk. He didn't like to read lines. If you ask him something about a line, and he had a terrible time reading lines. I don't know why. He just when he was such a clever performer when he was doing Seth Parker in the early days.
Yes, he played the title role. Didn't he? Of a small town,
yeah, small
family.
Town. Yeah, he had a good New England accent. And he was very good at it.
Who produced Warden Laws, the 20,000 Years in Sing Sing program?
I don't know. I remember it, but I don't recall it.
Another famous show. Crime show.
Very good, too. There was another one, Crime Does Not Pay, which was sort of like Gangbusters, of famous crimes of that time. Little, fewer machine guns.
Well, there was a big, you know, wave of those shows. There was This Is Your FBI, and Your FBI in Peace and War, and, of course, Mr. District Attorney, and...
There wasn't Mr. District Attorney a large show?
It was at the beginning. Then he sold that for a fabulous sum to some agency, and they kept it for many years.
That was Jay Johnson and Vicki Bola.
Vicki Bola playing
there. Miss Miller.
Yeah.
Well, now, you were another... you were David Harding Counterspy.
David Harding Counterspy. Well, that was a straight pillard package. It always stayed... And, except at the end, and he sold everything he had, I think, about 1950, wasn't it? We went down to WOR, and Lynn Bass still did it. But I think he sold everything he had to WOR or something for some millions or something like that. And but up until that time, for 8 or 9 years, it was his show done from his office. And of course, it was conceived during the war, and supposedly it was true case spy stories at that time. After the war was over, they had to fabricate to a great extent, and then it became almost pure fiction at the end. And then radio died out, and that was the whole story for them.
Did he ever produce anything for television? Because I never remember.
I don't think so.
The District Attorney was done on television, but by that time it was no longer his show, and it was done by Ed Byron direct with Ed Byron.
Well, he owned the show at that time.
I believe he owned it.
Ed Byron
for a while, but it
produced and directed that show for a long time in radio and on television.
And it never quite came off on television for any length of time, at least.
I wonder why he didn't attempt to go into television. That is. Because he didn't, you know, lack anything in the ego department where he thought he couldn't do it, from what I know about him.
No, that's an interesting question. I don't know why he... But maybe he was just tired of the whole thing and realized that television was going to be such a headache that he just thought he'd get out of it.
Maybe. He had all that lovely money.
And he had an awful lot of money out of it, and probably decided he went into some other business in Maine for a while, and then I heard got into the boat business, so...
I think he'd have the excitement and he'd have the success and the building up of his properties in radio and many years of that kind of success. And after that, he probably lost interest. He didn't want to start again doing something in a new medium.
I mean, a lot of things. A lot of people felt that same way about television, I think. They got out while the flag was still high, you know.
What were some of the other programs you two worked on radio?
Oh, the Aldrich family, Cavalcade of America.
And all the soaps.
Yeah.
Every soap, I used to see Dryden going to 4 and 5 shows a day on a good day. And it was fabulous.
We saw each other.
I did Road of Life. I played Jim Brent, Called Surgery, and...
Dr. Brent, Barnett, Surgeon.
Yeah, I mean, I was about the third Dr. Brent. It started in Chicago, and then came here, and I was the third or fourth Dr.
That
Brent.
Got a lot of mileage and jokes on the radio in those days.
Yeah, you never did get there. And,
were you on Joyce Jordan, Girl Intern, at any time?
No, I didn't do any of High Brown shows at all. But I did Counter Spy, and then I had a lot of fun. I think the most fun, really, we ever had was the Tennessee Jed, you know, with the marvelous, the shot, and then the ricochet, and then somebody, Cord Benson, screamed, got him, Tennessee Jed, dead center. Of course, his head was made of steel because the bullet bounced right off. But it was a marvelous show, real shoot-em-up western, and... I didn't jump around. I was not a good doubler. Bob here is a very fine doubler, and he can go from show to show. And not, but I had high, low, and they all sounded the same.
You want my high voice? You want my low voice?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you worked either of you worked another Phillips H. Lord show, We the People, but I guess they didn't really use actors.
Yes,
that,
they did. They had dramatic. I worked it a couple of times. They usually had the people in that had done something, but they had sometimes put dramatizations in there somewhere. Did you work it, Bob?
I worked We the People, but not for Phillips Lord. It seems to me around that time, in the late 30s, Phillips Lord sold his interest in We the People.
Yeah, about the same time.
Which he created to either a sponsor or an advertising agency.
I think Alan Rubicam bought it, Annie.
I think his only interest in the show was the weekly royalty that he was paid for the idea.
Which I understand was a fabulous piece of money he got every week as long as that thing was on. And it went on forever. Oh, he knew how to make it.
I remember some mistakes on We the People. Now, unfortunately, I can't remember any specifically, but as I recall, the person who had this unusual experience, which is why they were brought on the program, and someone told me that they do sort of a rehearsal with them, and many times people who were amateurs, I guess all of them, you know, people from all walks of life, would be fine when they knew it was not a live mic. And when then they said, now we're going network, this is, you know, coast to coast, and when the man points his finger at you, you tell the story, and they absolutely went to pieces.
Yeah. I remember
a lot of professional actors froze exactly the same way their first time on radio, or first or second or third time on radio. The idea of millions of people listening on the other side of that little microphone that was standing on the floor was a pretty frightening thing.
I was talking about that sort of thing with Mary Margaret McBride a couple of weeks ago. I went up to visit her in the Catskills. And I said, you know, I don't understand that people being getting mic fright. And she said, well, of course you don't. You tape record. And I said, well, yes, I guess I do. But that had never occurred to me. I have done a couple of live programs, but it never really bothered me, you know, being live. And she said, you wait and see. You'll be scared. And I said, no, I don't think so. So recently I did the Today Show. And the first time I sat down at that desk, you know, that you sit with that girl, I can't think of her name, and Hugh Downs, and he said, about 15 seconds before they were to come in to us, they were doing a commercial. He said, are you scared? And I said, no. Well, they had given me a script, which I hate because I'm not an actor. And they said, now, this is what Hugh Downs is going to ask you. And here are your answers. Now, you don't have to answer them verbatim, but keep your answers limited to this. And now we're going to show these pictures on the screen, and you comment. And I said, fine. He said, now, be careful because we're timed, and you're the last segment. So you can't go over, and don't go under. I said, well, I understand. I think it'd be all right. So Hugh Downs says, you understand? I said, yes. He said, you ready? Did you see the script? I said, yes. He said, all right, here we go. And the red light went on, and he said nothing that had anything to do with the script I saw. The pictures that they showed me on that script were never shown.
Oh, a dirty fool.
I still don't know what the reason was. It threw me completely. Yeah. If they hadn't said they had a problem with time, it wouldn't have, because I was familiar with the material. But I kept thinking, well, am I long or am I over or under? And you lose, as you know, all sense of time when it was light and it's color TV and there's light coming everywhere.
Terrifying.
That was my debut.
Well, with years and years of experience, you're still not free from this sort of thing. One of our most famous radio actresses came on Counter Spy after a great career in daytime radio, and I'll never forget her saying, she finally had to rush over and supposedly pick up the phone and say, and she said, operator, get me the Scouter pies. And I'll tell you, it went coast to coast just as clear as a bell. You know, we all dropped to the floor. We lived in deadly fear of something like that. You know, just a simple, what is that, a spoonerism? A simple thing like that happening. But we lived in deadly fear that someday we would do it.
Do you miss radio, both of you?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I miss a lot of things about radio, yes. I miss the confraternity of people we had in those days. Television is a much more cut-and-dried operation. Well, there's no live television at all anymore, but even in the days of live
television... There is, too.
Yeah, he does it, doesn't he?
Well, I don't mean daytime shows. I mean evening shows, which are all either on film from the coast or on tape. There's no more. Aside from the soap operas, Don.
Yes, excuse me. All right.
Sorry about that. There is no more live television or film television in New York. But in the days, the earlier days of all live television, the feeling, the camaraderie, if you want to call it that, of people gathering together a number of times a week in a studio or out of a studio and talking about the show after it was off the air, and the immediacy of radio, of live radio, just went by the board with radio.
Well, we had an awfully good time going to between shows. We did two or three shows. There were, you know, hours that we'd have to be in town, and there were hangouts like the restaurant, the Colby's, or over in NBC, and you'd always find your friends in there because they would be between certain shows. And it was a real fraternal group. Everybody said hello, and everybody was laughing it up, and nobody was under much of a nervous strain because once the show was over, you relaxed, and the physical effort like you have in television was not there. You know, you're pooped after a television show because of the hours of rehearsal and of the strain of doing it and the tension and the concentration. And radio is a much more relaxed medium, and so we had, as we always say, we were stealing money in those days and didn't know it. But on the other hand, you had, I mean, I'm not belittling the work. You had to concentrate on your character, and a good radio actor did give something of himself during the show, but I don't think that the toll was like it is in television. And then we did have the time, so we had a lot of fun. It was
well, good. I think that old fun started to disappear, really, when live repeat shows started to disappear. I remember earlier on in radio, when you did a repeat for the West Coast, you came back at midnight, came to the same studio, and we did the same script again, live. And then they found out that they could record their repeat broadcasts, so everyone just went home after the first show. And there was none of this business of being in town two or three hours. Between shows and organizing a marvelous poker game. That's one of the great things I remember about Gangbusters, is the poker games that started first between shows. And then if rehearsal was called at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the poker players would gather at 12:30 or 1 o'clock and we'd start a game. And initially, the game stopped at 2 o'clock and we started to rehearse, and then we found that the game went on to 3 o'clock, and I always felt sorry for the people who didn't play poker, because it seemed that we gathered for poker and not for a radio show.
Well, I'll have to say thank you now, because we're running out of time. My guests today have been Don McLaughlin and Mr. Bob Dryden, radio actors, performed a great deal on Gangbusters and David Harding, Counter Spy. And I have another radio program coming up in the near future, A Man from One Man's Family.
Oh.
Paige Gilman, who is now a journalist in Southern California. He played Jack of the Barber family.
Oh, yeah.
From the first broadcast, which is April 29th, 1932, to the last. And I believe that was 1959. One Man's Family, right. From the beginning to the end. And next week, we're going to have a high tea program rather than whatever became of it. My guest will be Miss Tallulah Bankhead. It will be a 90-minute program beginning at the same time. So thanks again, and next week, high tea with Tallulah Bankhead. Good night.